Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Deputy Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
This week, we are just going to get into some big news, some big changes happening in Engadget, folks. And if you missed us last week, it's because of everything going on our side right now. Mm-hmm. But let me just say up front, if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. That's always great. Drop us emails at podcastengadget.com because you may have some feedback after this episode. So last week, as we were preparing to, you know, record the Engadget podcast, we got the news that a whole bunch of people from Engadget were being laid off and our overall structure was being changed a bit. So we were all just kind of dealing with the whiplash of that last week, and we couldn't quite put a show together, I think, mentally. It was just kind of rough. I didn't know, like, what was your feeling, Sherlyn, there?
Yeah. Devendra, you also know this, but just for everyone to kind of paint a picture, you know how I love to paint my pictures. At about 8-ish a.m., some people across our team, you know, started to have meetings with HR, and you know that's never a good sign. And I think by 9:30 is when we started to get the extent of what was happening. And I will summarize for all of you what happened just after this. But yeah, the first thing I told Devendra and Ben was like, hey, could we maybe at least postpone
recording today? Pause and then, yeah.
I was like, maybe I'll be a little late. I'm finding out what's happening. And then afterwards, I was like, no. Actually, I don't think we can even do this recording today. So that's what happened. It was a very last minute decision for us to not do the recording of the podcast last week. So I hope you all understand. What overall did happen was we had layoffs of 10 individual people from the Engadget team. Mostly editorial, and that's a significant cut because our team was only like 30-something people at most. So it's about a third of our team. It includes people like our editor-in-chief, Dana Wollman, our managing editor, Terrence O'Brien, our editor-at-large, James True, and then people across the team like Matt Bryan, who maybe you might not have heard him a lot on this podcast because he's based in the UK.
And he's managing news over there. So
he was an integral part of the news team. Brian O, our video head, and Joel Chikatsu, our other video producer. Basically, we lost our whole video team. Mike Morris, our social media manager, as well as John Turi, our homepage editor, Katie Malone, our security senior security reporter, and Richard Lai, our senior reporter based in Asia as well. So
a lot of them long-time Engadget people, by the way.
So many. John Turi, close to what, 15 years maybe? Dana and Terrence were both 13 or 14 years, and Richard, 15, I think. Brian and Mike, closer to me in terms of timing, so more like 7 or 8 years. Katie had just joined, so that's not very nice. And Joelle also had just joined, and just it felt like we were gutted. But I don't know what else really.
I mean, I think the main thing is that, hey, this is rough, and you've probably seen a lot of news reports going out.
Exactly.
Because I've seen. It's tough when you become the news because we are normally, you know, the people reporting on the news. But, you know, things are happening. Structurally, there are some changes too, right? Like our team is being split into straight up news and features and also a separate team for reviews and buying advice and things like that, commerce posts. So, hey, we're organizationally going to be split up a bit. A lot of us are still here, Sherlyn and me and Sam Rutherford and Aaron Soporis, a lot of the team are still here. And I think the main takeaway here is that Engadget's still here. We're still going to keep doing our thing. I have reviews that I've been mentally trying to trudge through because also dealing with all this is not fun. But we are still here. We love to hear, you know, from our listeners and our readers about what they're thinking about all this. But hey, it's not just us. Media right now is kind of falling apart, right? We saw a whole bunch of layoffs at our sister site, TechCrunch. There was big news last week. Vice.com. Vice is falling apart and laying off tons of people. And they also announced that they're not going to publish on Vice.com anymore. And I think we even talked about like the mess happening at the Messenger and elsewhere too. So media is facing a lot of issues right now. Tech, the gaming industry, like it's not great for any big corporations here. I do want to say, when it comes to our coverage, nothing is really changing on our end. We have talked to the people in charge, and we, you know, have gotten assurance that there's like going to be no AI written posts, which is the thing that I think really affected CNET and the credibility of CNET and the other sites. It's just not a thing we're doing, thankfully. But we're going to keep doing what we do, which is reviews, news posts, thought pieces around that news. There's a great piece from Dan Cooper that we'll be talking about this this episode. So it's going to be the same old Engadget, maybe fewer people publishing on the site, but I hope, you know, everybody sticks around because we're going to keep it going.
Yeah, I can't stress how important it is. I think that if you're a person that's listening to the podcast right now, you're someone who likes the Engadget brand and you like us and you want us to stick around. I'm assuming if you don't, then like send me an email, man. let's chat. I'm
why did they come here to boo us?
Yeah. It's okay to me. It's if you're like Simpsons. This far in the podcast, you're still listening. You probably like us. And I know that, you know, a lot of people want to help and send their best wishes. You can always send that our way podcast at engadget.com. But I do want to say that I think what Devinder was talking about that's impacting the entire media industry is the result of, you know, Google's dominance in ads, in SEO, and its control. And so you get people who are able to make little tweaks to their site and headlines and then take over, you know, other publications and that sort of stuff. I'm not a big fan of that, but I can't, you know, lie. It has a huge impact on how we have to be and operate.
It's nothing new. It's not, like, that has been around for 20 years, or, you know.
It is nothing new. And like AI, that's nothing new, but it's also, you know, coming up. It's, however, not sustainable. I will tell you that me, Devendra, our whole team, we're dedicated to good quality work above everything. But we need people to be aware of that. We need people to be like keeping their eyes open and knowing how to discern between good quality work and not so good quality work, and then continue to support by visiting the sites that you like. I'm not really doing anything here other than encouraging people to be a bit more like critical about the types of media they consume and maybe a bit more like aware of like things that you see out there. And that said, you know, we are aware that SEO isn't like a long-term play. And we as a team are coming up with ideas as to how to survive and how to stick around.
I mean, we just had that discussion, Sherlyn, around the AI search engine too, right? And which was stripping ads and a lot of stuff from sites just to deliver information. I think that is kind of part of it too. The shape of what search engines will be like Google is testing AI results at the top of searches right now. Eventually, that will be the full play for them and a lot of other companies. The big takeaway. We're here. Send us feedback. Yeah.
If Google, you're listening, you talk to me. We'll talk about how, let's talk to me about how you're going to help us survive in this landscape with your AI search. Or Microsoft, you know, if you're listening to Apple, hit me up. And if you're not any of those still, and you want to like send us your support, you know, words of encouragement, we welcome it. Again, podcasting here, myself, Sherlyn, C-H-E-R, at Engadget.com. Also, if you want to reach a smaller group, that's fine.
I'll say, if people have been asking, like, how do we support us and make sure we're okay, you know, yeah, read the site, like you're saying, Sherlyn, but also share things, talk about things. We turned off comments a couple of weeks ago, too. That was a surprise decision to me. But we can have a dialogue around stuff anywhere. So that's a whole thing. That's a whole separate thing. Like, I think comments on websites, I have seen the good and the bad. And I think ultimately, I'm like, Maybe not worth it unless you have like somebody dedicated to building that community. So that's a whole thing. But I hope people, you know, keep reading, share our stuff, and send us feedback. That's really everything.
Review this podcast on iTunes.
Yeah, review this podcast on iTunes.
Want us
definitely.
To stick around? Yeah.
If you love a thing, support a thing. That's like the main thing I tell people. Same with like, you know, media or pop culture. If you like it, buy it. I think that will show the people in charge that, hey, things are appreciated, and these listeners and readers exist. So with that, we're going to move on to news. We're going to have a normal episode as best we can, and we're going to keep trucking at Engadget.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So let's move on to some other news. And I think the big thing that was kind of revealed this week is Bloomberg's Mark Gurman reported that the Apple Car Project, aka Project Titan, is dead, is officially dead. Nearly 2,000 employees who had been working it are going to be moved over to Apple's artificial intelligence division, where they'll be working on generative AI stuff. They're saying like Apple may say more about it later this year. I have thoughts about this because I'm somebody who's been thinking about like where transportation sits and where EVs sit and for us right now. But Sherlyn, I'm interested. What was your first thought hearing this? Did you ever think the Apple Car was a thing that was actually going to happen?
Maybe given the headspace I'm in right now, my immediate reaction was, so who's going to be laid off? did they get rid of
that
a bunch of EV people?
That is always the question. Yes. Yeah.
I think that I believe they made a lot of hires and were like researching it. But I don't think I ever thought I would see the day an Apple Car was launched. I mean, I think it would be intriguing, but they've never made a product of this size. I think there's a lot of moving parts to that sort of assembly, that sort of production that know that Apple is equipped to handle. I think they're more equipped to handle things like in the healthcare space or in the VR space. But a car, that's a lot. That's like lives at risk.
That's true. This is true. But I mean, what is a car today, Sherlyn? That is my question to you. What is an electric car? It's a computer on wheels. And that is why we have seen a bunch of companies come out of nowhere to build pretty good electric cars. Like I just tested the Rivian R1S. Tesla has been around for over a decade. And I've got more to say about like Tesla specifically. Companies have proven they can come out of nowhere with very little, like honestly, personal experience to build viable electric cars. And that's been an important thing because I think a lot of the traditional automotive like companies were just dragging their heels. We talked about the story about like Toyota, a company I typically love and support, but Toyota fell victim to the innovator's dilemma, where they did so well with hybrids, like the Prius became such a thing. It became a symbol of eco-conscious drivers and whatnot. When it came time to be like, okay, we got to start thinking about EVs, Toyota's like, but we really like selling hybrids. People really like Priuses. And that was the question Apple faced as they were like developing the iPhone, right? Like, should we make this thing that will make people stop buying iPods? Is that actually a good thing for us? And, you know, Apple forged ahead. A lot of companies would be afraid to do this. And traditional car companies absolutely failed. So it was Tesla who really like kicked the industry in the pants and kind of got things started. And let's not talk about Tesla today, because I think Tesla today is kind of a symbol of Elon Musk and his like own stupidity and his like downfall as a technological leader and thinker. But here's my hot take, which I didn't have time to write about, but Dan Cooper over at Engadget wrote a great thing about why the Apple Car never felt real. My hot take is Tesla already built the Apple Car. Tesla did everything Apple traditionally would have done when entering a new market.
It was very Apple-y, yeah.
Yeah, they made it sleek. They made it premium. They infused it with computing throughout. And honestly, really smart features for the people who've had Teslas for the past 10 years. They have had crazy good features that other car drivers just never had access to. Tesla also completely disrupted the way you buy a car, because you can't walk into a Tesla store and buy a car. You walk into the Tesla outlets and you can look at a car, you can test drive a car, and then you go back to the website and you buy it online. And the thing about the way cars work in America, it's insane. Like car dealers, like it's really, it has to be all through car dealers, or major car manufacturers can only sell things through dealerships, which are, I'm sorry if anybody's listening to this and is a car dealer, but they're the scum of the earth. Like the whole dealership setup is like a ridiculous farce in America. But because of the way we have things set up, it is illegal for car companies to directly sell you things. And that is what Tesla figured out, too. So that was part of it, being able to like configure your car online, get it delivered to your house. They kind of upended the whole traditional car buying and selling platform. And I think that's a big part of it. And they also pushed ahead on key features. Like, say what you will about their self-driving stuff, full self-driving and whatnot. It's not great. It is not exactly what Elon Musk said it would be. I think Tesla overmarketed it and lied about a lot of this tech. But I also know a lot of people who have been using it smartly, who have been using it like very smart cruise control. They've driven thousands of miles and their cars on the highway will still do most of the work. And that is something a lot of car companies also ended up following, like Toyota and Volvo and others eventually adapted similar sorts of like driving assistance, you know, features and whatnot. But they're still not as good as Tesla's. So Tesla built the Apple car, which is why the idea of an Apple car feels redundant. I think that's the thing. They're like, what else can Apple do? The early reporting was Apple is like, oh, we're working on the future of transportation. This vehicle doesn't have a steering wheel, right? This is just something you sit in and it completely drives itself. And then have you been paying attention to like the self-driving industry and all that stuff, Sherlyn?
Sort of Waymo, right?
Like, yeah. It fell apart. Like there was so much hype a decade ago, even up to like 5 years ago, companies were investing billions of dollars in this and it kind of fell apart because it's a bigger problem.
Killing people. No.
Yeah. Well, cars kill people. That is another unfortunate like downside of all this, but it's a harder problem than a lot of them solve. The tech we had to solve it wasn't quite there. And yeah, the self-driving cars are causing accidents or running over pedestrians. I will say the net amount of that compared to actual cars driven by humans that are doing dumb things and hurting people like is actually far worse. But the self-driving cars will get the headlines, right? Because it's a new thing. People are afraid of it. And it's just like that whole industry kind of fell apart too. So the latest report we talked about was Apple's car could just be an EV. An EV from Apple coming in like 2028. And I think by that point, everyone's like, so what's the point? What's so Apple about it, right? I think that's the thing. You expect Apple to do something new and different. Even looking at the Vision Pro, right? It is doing a lot of things differently and I think smartly, even though it's still like dealing with a lot of the issues inherent with like VR headsets. So what do you think? Tesla made the Apple car, Sherlyn. Do you think that idea checks out?
Mm-hmm. I think more than just Tesla made the Apple car, you might be right in that Tesla made it so the Apple car is redundant. I think even more than, you know, like, the one point, because I feel like you said, like, I don't want to give Elon Musk too much credit is really what it is. A lot of these features, it is very Apple-y. And in the same way that like when Apple does something, everyone else copies, Tesla did the same thing and everyone else copied. Like I see Tesla design in Rivian vehicles. I see it in, you know, Volvos or GM vehicles, like all kinds of things that, you know, every now and then I step into a show, like a booth at CES with a car. And I'm like, oh, okay, this looks like a Tesla.
Well, because they have a big ass tablet typically. Right. And that was the thing.
Right.
Tesla
and then
first,
the very minimalist everywhere else, the design, the, like the fact that they just want to like change door handles just cause they can now. I'm like, all right, well, I guess we're going to Teslaify everything.
That is all about drag coefficient and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing with
the EV, without the, like, the streamlining the outside.
Yeah, you want it to streamline. So a door handle is like these things that poke out and kind of like mess up with your airflow. So in an EV, like a lot of them, most of them now, they kind of go flush with the car. And they're annoying to use, I'll admit. Yeah.
I was watching a video, and this is a slight tangent, but like about an interview with the makers of the Cybertruck, and they were like, oh yeah, they wanted to turn their like side mirrors into cameras instead of like using actual mirrors. And I was like, are you serious? The lag alone will kill you. Like,
I mean, a lot of some cars are doing that now, Sherlyn, so.
I do not.
It's a thing. Cute little Honda, the cute little like Honda two-seater that Steve Dent tested in France. Like,
yeah.
Yes. It's weird.
I mean, that plus like if you run out of battery or like there's some kind of feed malfunction, you're dead. Like,
you're dead. Okay. I mean, listen, it's a whole other thing. But if somebody goes by and smashes your side mirror, which is super easy to do, you're screwed in that respect, too. But you're right. A lot of people did copy what Tesla did. I think Rivian is a really interesting company to look at right now. The R1S and the R1T, their electric truck and SUV have been really favorably reviewed. The customers getting them generally love these things. Like, these are high quality cars made from a company that was working on it for, I think, about a decade and was quiet about it for a very long time. But it seems like they're going through trouble. Like, they're going through trouble when it comes to actually selling these things and building these things. I'm just looking at their market cap, which is like it's $11 billion now for Apple to Apple. That's kind of nothing. I feel like that could be an interesting just chomp, like a nice bite for Apple at some point, just to deal with a lot of the problems that they apparently had while designing a car on their own, like just to take over a lot of what Rivian does and then implement the Apple-y stuff. That's a whole thing. People have pointed out, like, Amazon is actually the current largest outside investor in Rivian, because, and they're also using Rivian, like, delivery vans, which you may see around. Like, those are the Amazon fans that look kind of cool and electrically. So Rivian, like, may go to somebody else, but I feel like if Apple were to do anything, it would probably be a company like Rivian. I think it's still worth doing. Like, if you live in a city, you probably don't have to deal with this a lot. But anybody outside of a city, as I learned when I moved to the suburbs of Georgia, is like, you need a car. You need something good that can take care of your family. You need it to be safe and reliable and to take you places and make you feel comfortable driving too, and also not kill the environment. So America's car-centric culture, that's not going to change anytime soon. I would love for this to lead to like more public transportation stuff down the line, but I think there's a lot of good reasons for Apple to try to pursue this. It seems weird for them to just completely give up, but maybe they just couldn't do it on their own.
Or donate that money or something. I don't know. I'm just really, really, I think, stung about like how people spend money now. And it's like,
I mean, cool. These companies gotta spend money. But apparently it was 10 years and billions of dollars, multiple leadership changes that led to like this ultimate decision from Apple. Who knows? We don't know what any of this really means. But I do want to point out to go check out Daniel Cooper's editorial about this, about why the Apple Car never felt real and why it never quite fit in with the Apple image. You know, if you're trying to be an eco-centric, company that cares about the environment, putting out a car, which even if it's an EV, will require a lot of batteries. Right. Like it'll require a lot of minerals to deal with. What tires leave on the road and put into the air is a thing more and more people are talking about, and apparently is going to continue to be a problem with EVs. So those are all things Apple and other EV makers will have to consider. I'd be interested in hearing if anybody looking forward to an Apple car. Are you disappointed about hearing this news? Apple is still in other cars right now. Don't forget, like, CarPlay is a big thing. I think for a lot of people, CarPlay is the preferred way to like interface your phone. And the next generation CarPlay that I think they debuted for some Mercedes cars, the one like takes over a whole bunch of your screens, that looks really cool. So maybe that's all Apple needs to do for now. But I don't know, as a fully integrated hardware and software company, it feels like at some point you got to have your own car. You got to do, or at least be really close to a company that's doing that. Sony teamed up with Honda to build their, a Fila car? So like that is a thing that could end up happening. All these companies are kind of exploring that. So, hey, we shall see. If you have thoughts about this, drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We also saw a rumor, a report from last week where there's some stories we're like carrying over that we didn't get to talk about. But we are hearing details about Nintendo's Switch follow-up, the Switch 2 or whatever they end up calling it, may not actually arrive until 2025. And the reporting I've read is that it sounds like Nintendo cannot make enough to satisfy potential demand if they were trying to get it out for the holidays. So rather than have like a crazy big stock crush or something, they're just pushing in a couple months into 2025 for whatever this thing ends up being. So a more powerful Switch, maybe with some new features, will likely get announced at some point this year. I think it would be interesting if Nintendo does this, because it literally means like, oh, you're just giving up the holidays. You're telling people don't buy a Switch this Christmas.
Right.
And I feel like Nintendo would be one of those rare companies that's like, yeah, well, you know, we'll just deal with that because we know you're going to buy a Switch 2 whenever we announce it, right? Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts, Sherlyn? Because I know you are a Switch player. You're a big Cooking Mama player.
I don't know. I mean, my current Switch works fine. I'd have to be convinced, right? Like, they'd have to bring, you know, a lot to the table. So I guess giving them more time to do that and using that time to save some money, I guess, is not a bad thing to me. But yeah, I came at it with a very practical perspective instead of like, oh yeah, technologically, or as like a sort of gamey person, I am interested. I don't know. There's a lot out there in the handheld, like,
there's so much out there now.
Space, the competition is so tough that I actually don't mind them taking the time to like regroup and be like, what can we do better, you know?
It is amazing that the Switch is a piece of hardware that came out on March 1st, 2017. That is a while ago. And we are still running ages. Pretty much the same hardware. The refresh that they added, I think they like made the actual system on a chip a little slimmer and added a more capable battery, like it's more efficient. So the newer Switch models have slightly higher battery life. But that same basic hardware is what's in devices, you know, still right now. And they can play amazing looking games like Zelda, Breath of the Wild, and Tears of the Kingdom. So, hey. Good for them. Maybe Nintendo, again, the company that's like, hey, you don't have to play this rat race. You don't have to be like Microsoft, who's like, we got the most GPU horsepower in this box, so you should. Our box is better. I've always appreciated how Nintendo is very different about this stuff. The original Switch ran a custom version of NVIDIA's Tegra X1 chip, which is a thing we don't even talk about anymore. Like NVIDIA's Tegra chips, or Tegra, or however you pronounce it. Just amazing stuff. I'm excited about the Switch 2, but like I've said before, I'm a Nintendo fanboy. Like I will just be on it. Whatever they end up doing. I bought a Switch OLED last year because I was just like, well, I want to play Tears of the Kingdom on the best looking Nintendo handheld I can get. So that is what we're doing right now. My daughter and I are playing that together. I also bought this cool little I forget the company that did it, but one of the companies that made like a cool controller extension to like dock your Switch into and have better buttons and whatnot. I'm using one of those, and that also makes the experience better. So I'm still investing in this technology that is way, way too old. similarly related, there was a lot of news last week about, actually, I guess 2 weeks ago at this point, but a lot of follow-up news last week about what Microsoft is doing in the console business. A couple of weeks ago, Microsoft revealed that they're bringing 4 games to other platforms. We learned that that would end up being something like, I believe, Sea of Thieves coming to PlayStation 5. Hi-Fi Rush also coming to PlayStation 5. Also, Pentiment would be coming to Nintendo Switch and PlayStation 5 too. So these are games that Microsoft says are over a year old. They've been a part of their like Game Pass platform too. Hey, they saw value in opening it up to other platforms, which have more players. PlayStation 5 is vastly outselling Xbox at this point. To open it up to other gamers, to let them just buy that thing if they want. I guess that just makes sense. Because Microsoft, a lot of people forget, they have Minecraft out there on other platforms. They have games that they make and produce available on other consoles. This isn't exactly new from them. Our editor, Aaron Soporis, wrote a really interesting think piece saying Microsoft should exit the console business. And I think there's some good thoughts in there. I don't know if you have... Do you have thoughts about this, Sherlyn? Because right now, Microsoft is kind of losing it in consoles. The Xbox is dying against the PlayStation 5. And it feels like Microsoft has lost this entire generation. Do you think there's value in Microsoft still having a box out there compared to, you know, Sony and Nintendo?
Yeah, I think there's value in competition, right? I mean, again, to be like pontificating on the entire world at large, like we've seen what happens when competition dwindles. We've seen, you know, all of that stuff happens. So I think, and Microsoft is a big name. I can see that Microsoft might be heading towards like relying more on software and game titles and that's, and you know, developing more games to sustain its business. And on other parts of its business, I could see how Microsoft hardware is struggling as well. So like for it to abandon hardware completely could save it a lot of money and that sort of stuff. I don't know, though. I think there is a world where Xbox fans are going to be very disappointed if that happens. I don't disagree with Aaron, though. I think he makes a very good point. But I would like to see like a different competitor come up before Microsoft leaves, if that makes sense.
I totally agree. We are thinking the same line, Sherlyn. I think like the headline of Aaron's piece, and I wish he was here to like talk about it with us.
Yeah.
But I'm sure on a whiteboard somewhere in Microsoft's office, this idea is out there. Like, among the things they could do is just leave consoles, you know? And that would save them a lot of money. It would probably save them a lot of headache. They would probably still make a ton of money, you know, bringing games to PlayStation and Nintendo and everything. But you'll never, like, those systems will never support Game Pass. Like, if Microsoft wants to make Game Pass
thing, I see that. You're right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They need to have their own thing. And Game Pass right now is available on a handful of TVs separately. I think some Samsung TVs. But it's still very much
PCs,
a thing.
PCs, I guess, right?
Hmm? Yeah.
PCs, right?
I mean, well, no, definitely machines. PCs. But I'm talking about like in your living room, on your couch. Right, Game Pass is right now on some TVs and on Xbox consoles. I think the idea of what a piece of hardware could be in a couple of years could be very different. Like, could Microsoft just market a really cheap dongle that you pair a controller to that lets you play games over the cloud if that stuff ends up being better?
That would be so cool, yeah.
It would be cool. Their cloud gaming, like, works really well. I'm not sure if that's ready for everybody. That's not fully ready for the mainstream because not everybody has a great internet connection, but that could change, you know?
I will say this right now. There's like an Xbox gaming stick that costs less than the console. I would buy it now.
For sure.
Especially because like I don't have the space or the money to really want to buy an Xbox or PlayStation, but I would buy a dongle.
A dongle.
The way like I guess when like Google wanted to make Stadia happen, they kind of did like Chromecasty related things with it.
They did.
That they did, but like I guess
that's how you exactly don't do any of this stuff.
Don't just frickin' do that, Google. I guess. Don't. Also, Google. I feel like Google just didn't have the titles to really back up. Like,
they had some good titles, but what Google did to refresh everybody was like, hey, buy this thing. We'll also subscribe to our service, but also you got to buy these games separately. You also have to buy these games. And I think it's Microsoft's whole thing is just like, hey, if you buy this $100 dongle, right, which comes with a controller and maybe 3 months of Game Pass. And after that,
I would do that.
You pay $15 a month to play games over the cloud. I could see that being a thing. I could see instead of playing the high end rat race against Sony's boxes. And even right now, like Phil Spencer, the head of Xbox, says that Microsoft has some genuinely powerful hardware coming down the line. I don't think any of that's not what they need. They don't need more power. Like, they have a ton of power. The Xbox Series X is technically more powerful than the PlayStation 5, but they don't have the games people really want to play. Like, that's the ultimate thing. They've lived through a lot of delays with this platform. Halo Infinite was delayed by over a year. It was supposed to be there at launch. They don't have a lot of great exclusives. A lot of the great games are available on both PlayStation and Xbox. So if you're a gamer who can only buy one new console, you're better off going PlayStation 5 because you get those crazy good Sony exclusives like Spider-Man and Last of Us and everything. Mm-hmm. Whereas Microsoft is like, you could buy this box. We also have a cheaper box. You could also get a PC that'll also work with Game Pass, right. Some of those subscriptions, and they will also sell you games on PCs.
They're kind of like the Apple and Google of gaming, aren't they? Like,
I mean,
PlayStation has a lot more vertical control and like fewer maybe like branches of where you can play their games, I guess. And then Microsoft has like all these different platforms you can like, and it's more open.
I mean, Microsoft is the Microsoft of the console market. Like, it's what they did with PCs, right? I almost wonder if like they sold a box for Lynn that was like, okay, if you still want a powerful $500 box, here is an Xbox. It can also run Windows.
Like a computer, like I just would attach a mouse and keyboard.
It's an Xbox. It's a $500 Xbox that can also run Windows, like on your desk or on your living room or something. Would that be a thing to some people? I feel like for tinkerers, they would be like, "Oh, that's interesting."
I could see a niche for that for sure. I mean, not for me, but yeah.
Not for you, who loves Windows and PCs.
I do love Windows, but I don't want to work on my TV.
You don't want to work on your TV. Yeah. You're right. You are absolutely right. But what if that was something that could just be hooked up to like a gaming monitor instead of your TV? What if it was more like a portable gaming PC rather than
I do like the idea. Yeah. You're right. Like, because it comes with Windows, it could run a lot more applications. So I could run like Steam games. I could run like Plex on there to a bigger screen or something. I don't know. I could see that being intriguing. I don't know if there are already things out there that do that, you know, like a mini PC can do that.
Oh, there are absolutely mini PCs out there, but there aren't like any with the power of Microsoft or like the ability to like get hardware cheaper than everybody else. We never really got a full on like Surface desktop, right? We never got that. We got the Surface Studio, which is the tilty iMac thing, but just give me a box that's filled with hardware and like is Microsoft
like
approved?
An all-in-one. Yeah. Oh no, not even all-in-one, like just compared the box. To the Mac Mini.
Yeah. So anyway, I think, like you were saying, there are a lot of good reasons to keep doing hardware. Like, I don't want Microsoft to leave this industry and just be like, okay, the only console makers now are Nintendo and Sony. That is not a good thing for anybody, even though the Sony fanboys will like take that as a huge win. That's not a huge win when Sony's like, oh, okay, cool. Games are $80 now. There's no competition. Suck it. Like, that's literally what they will do. So this is why competition is better, and other companies driving down prices is better. So yeah, we will see. There's a lot of stuff going on there. What do you think about all the Google generative AI stuff now, Sherlyn? Because we wanted to talk about that last week as well.
Yeah. Early last week, I think we all heard from Google that a series of things. One is that they were renaming a bunch of their AI to Gemini across all of their other products as well. So like Duet AI for Businesses is now called Gemini.
It's now called Gemini. And also there's a thing called Gemma, which is an even lighter weight AI.
Right. I think that even happened the week before. I can't remember when exactly, because everything feels like a blur now.
I think it was like the day before, but it's all happened around the same time.
Gemma, to be clear, is more of a lighter weight open source version of Gemini. So it's like for people to kind of tinker around with, I guess, to play with. The fact that their naming standards are... Mm-hmm. Sorry, go on.
Well, Gemini is Gemma is meant to be free. You're saying open source too. So Gemini is a thing you have to pay for. Like, I think that's the other thing we're seeing right now. Yeah.
Right. The fact that they're exactly. So a lot of stuff is happening in this space. So Google renaming things and launching new things named Gemma and stuff like that. You can tell GEM, right? Gem is part of their whole desire to kind of, I guess, like a, brand recognition.
I don't know. Something. Will a feature thing just be called Gem? Because it seems like they're just getting smaller and smaller right now. And then Google G, just we go right back around in history to Google G.
If you think about, if you look at actually what Google said when it announced Gemma stuff, it did base the word Gemma on like Gem. Like the naming rationale behind it was based on like this kind of like, I forget the etymology behind it. It's like either some kind of Greek mythology or some kind of like rock formation. I forget which one right now because it's been a while. But amidst all of that renaming, like the big, great big AI renaming over at Google, we also, I think last week, saw in the news cycle that Google's image generating AI just could not for the life of them figure out how to like... produce historical figures that were not like diverse for some reason, for no reason really. I think we were seeing that.
I'll say specifically, conservative commentators, funny enough, were really quick to find that these generative AI image things were not creating images of white people, especially for historical figures.
Yeah.
That was
a
problem.
To get direct about it, Gemini would refuse to produce results for prompts that specifically request for white people. So like if you say generate a, picture of
an African-American
couple standing in front of an airplane, it would work. A Chinese couple standing in front of a Chinese person on a basketball court, sure. But if you say like Caucasian person or white person standing somewhere, they just could not do it. And in addition, Gemini had issues producing historically accurate images. So like users would be like, can you produce an image of a German soldier during the Second World War? Gemini would give you pictures of black men and Asian women in Nazi uniform, which is completely inaccurate.
Completely inaccurate. If you ask for pictures of the founding fathers of America, right? It's all, I think it was entirely black.
Yeah, and then popes throughout the ages. These are some prompts that like came up as examples, and you would always just get people of color in these like images. So Google last week had to address that. So first thing they did was kind of to shut down the feature. And then it promised to fix, I think. Then it had to pause the feature altogether. And then later in the week, it published a blog post explaining why all of that happened. Devendra, I don't know about you, but do you like when a company explains why things got messed up?
Sure. I mean, listen, if you mess up, that is the least you could do. I feel like that is a fair thing to do.
I quite enjoy, actually, that they decided to explain.
Yeah, and it seems like it was like a diversity trigger or filter that was just like a little overexposed, I guess, or like was working a little too hardcore. Sundar Pichai, the Google CEO, said that it was unacceptable and they're going to work on fixing whatever is going on here. I just have to say, listen, this is a problem. This is a bug. This is going to get it fixed. I did love to see the Babylon Bee writer, which is a notoriously like shitty conservative rag, be like, I can't. Oh, my God. Google's getting rid of white people. everything we're saying is true. Can you? Oh my God. And seeing them like whip themselves up into fervor is kind of hilarious. But okay. And also Google, as a company, by the way, caught shit for its AI features, which like a decade ago would tag pictures of gorillas as black people. So
God,
Google has been
that...
under fire because their AI was not good enough for actually seeing people, you know, people of color. Now it's just like tilted a little hard the other way. The other problem, though, is that this stuff is just getting out there way too early. Like Google could have tested this if they weren't like rushing to compete with Copilot and everything. Google should have tested this. This is something any company would have run into. It didn't take like a Babylon Bee writer to kind of figure that out. So I hope this is an awareness that, hey, we should just test this stuff more and maybe slow your roll, everybody. I'm so tired of them. Anyway, I think the big takeaway here is, people just got to chill out with AI stuff and maybe test this stuff a little more. And a lot of the warnings we've been talking about over the last year end up being very, very true. It's going to be interesting to see with what happens with Copilot Trillion and like how much more Microsoft is leaning on it. I actually just did, I subscribed to the Copilot Pro feature because it finally showed up on my desktop. So I'll see if having ChatGPT 4 is more worth it or not.
Sure it'll show up in your articles that you find.
Yeah, all my... No, I don't use
no,
it.
No, we're not using AI for to write. Let's reiterate
we don't
that.
Do that. One cool tool, AI. I got to look up the name for that, but we did see a cool tool recently where like you could drop your text, stuff you've written in, and like it will have like an AI editor judge the quality of your copy. And to me, that is kind of interesting just to have like another pair of eyes be like, hey, you're too repetitive, bruh. Change up your language. Make this opening more impactful. For a budding writer, that could be useful. And again, this is one of those things we have to do where we're like, we have to figure out how we're using AI tools to more empower us rather than do the work for us, I guess. Let's move on to what's happening around Engadget. As we said, we've got a 20th anniversary coming up. We have a bunch of pieces timed up around that. Anything you want to say about that, Trillin?
So, yeah. It will kick off starting this weekend. Again, our birthday itself is March 2nd. And there are plenty of articles from around the team, including Devendra. I know you have a good story coming up. I'm working on something that will come up a bit later, but it will be like a month of coverage as opposed to kind of what we were thinking just a week before. Just given everything that's been happening with our team lately, we needed a bit more time to kind of edit, put things together while we pick up the pieces. So keep an eye out. I think it's going to be a reflective look on the last 20 years that Engadget's been around. Devendra, you've been with Engadget longer than I have. You know, we've all watched the industry change. I think it's a very interesting time to be celebrating 20 years or commemorating.
I mean, listen, it's been, I don't know when you started reading Engadget, Trillin, or blogs in general.
Forever ago,
I don't know. I'm not going to ask where you were in 2005 or 2004,
Singapore.
Like when all this started.
But I was reading it.
I'm not even going to ask, Trillin. I don't even want to time you or anything. Yeah. But I will say, I was like, you know, that was late college for me. And I was also reading technology sites. Like I've read places like, I think it was Ars Technica was around forever. Mm-hmm. Anantech was around forever. Tom's Hardware. All those places were like sites I used to read. And then like Engadget hit and Gizmodo hit. And these were like small and nimble blogs that were just like blowing news out there, like getting quick and dirty hits out, thoughts out there, reviews out there. And it was so exciting at the time. And I remember like for years after college, like I would apply to positions at Engadget or positions at Gizmodo, would never hear back. I'm still a little bitter about that now. but yeah, I would apply. And like, this was the exciting thing. Everybody wanted to get into like doing, if you were trying to do media stuff, like blogs were exciting because they were new and nimble and different and not a boring old company. And I think like that's clearly changed over time. And I think ultimately there was a flattening online where blogs ended up being, you know, absorbed into bigger media companies. But also the idea of like the trouble blogs have in terms of making money, it's the same trouble everybody has. It's, unless you're the New York Times and you have a huge pile of like subscribers, it is a problem for everybody if you're just relying on ads and things like that, which is why you're seeing more paid newsletters. You're seeing all sorts of things now. It has been a crazy time, but Engadget's still here. And yeah, hopefully we will be here for much, much longer. All right, let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. Things that we're enjoying. Shirley, anything you want to shout out?
Yeah, I saw, finally, I saw Poor Things over the weekend.
Nice.
It was a really good distraction from the hellscape. Emma Stone, I didn't even, I have this bad habit of going into like movies, not expecting anything, not knowing who's actually in the cast. So I wasn't expecting Willem Dafoe. I wasn't expecting Mark Ruffalo. He's amazing in Poor Things. I turned around and I was like, wait, Mark Ruffalo's in this? And then like people were like, shush. A lot of nudity that I wasn't expecting. So, you know, don't watch this with your kids. But
or your
a very
interesting I would say
or your parents.
Yeah,
I don't know what kind of relationship you have with your parents. You know, but as long as you're
this is I think a lot of people did not expect this, but this is a bit this is a movie big on sexy times, and you know,
yes,
depends on how comfortable you are with that, with your
parents. I recommend respecting the whatever the rated R sort of situation is over there. Just don't bring kids because it might not be appropriate, or you might have to have a talk with them after. But anyway, it is about I thought it was a science fiction, like fun, like time travel show.
Well, not time travel, maybe period. Right?
I know.
It's a period.
I misread the synopsis, but I will say the science in this, it's less about the science sort of proposition and more about, it is still, like, it's about this woman is almost Frankenstein in nature, the way the story is told. And it's in an alternate world where like science has developed very differently than what I expect. So you've got like chimeras just like casually popping out throughout the show, which is really interesting. But it is about like interplanting, I guess, like human organs in different parts of different animals even, or different parts of bodies. And I'm trying not to like give away things, but I think the basic premise is that, you know, that Emma Stone's basically this person that has like a different, like a grown woman's body, but like not the same brain. Right. Yeah. And then like she's experiencing the world, and the story was a lot different from what I expected in that it was not like a breakneck pace adventure of time travel and spies. It's more
how did you get time travel and spies from anything?
I don't know, but okay. I was like, yes. Whatever it is, though, it was really well acted. Made me question a lot of things that I know about the world. Beautiful, just the sets and everything, like the editing and the colors and everything, just gorgeous. And then I had to like really look at the book. I was like, the book that it was based off of, this 1997 or something, 1994 book called Poor Things. I was like, wow, who came up with this idea? It's a very fresh, like, I think it's fresh. I don't know if you agree with me, Doug.
No, it's very fresh. I loved it. It's very much Frankenstein. And I don't know if you've ever read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Shalyn. It is a thing.
Might have when I was younger, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, listen, basically widely acknowledged as like the first science fiction book ever made, right? And written by women. And that's something that the sci-fi has never really like fully embraced. I think like the idea of this movie is like it is a very like almost feminist take on the idea of Frankenstein and bringing a creature into the world, but also bringing a creature who has to like learn about the world and learn about, okay, what kind of person do I want to be? What philosophies do I want to follow?
Yeah,
how do I build myself up? I think it's really, really fascinating and a lot of fun too. Like it's gorgeous.
So much fun.
It's gorgeous. It's funny.
I love that the MCU people that I've loved, like Mark Ruffalo, Robert Downey Jr., have all been getting their moments to like really flex sort of some other muscles. So like Mark Ruffalo leaning hard into comedy was not something I was really expecting. He's been like, I know him from like 13 going on 30, right? Like that's my very first like memory of Mark Ruffalo. Mm-hmm. And then to watch him become Hulk and be like a bit humorous to like fully almost slapstick, I feel like, in Poor Things.
It's hilarious.
And then to have him like do that, and then Robert Downey Jr. winning for Oppenheimer was awesome too. The other thing I would say is like I didn't know that the SAG Awards was streaming live on Netflix. I did go back to watch the awards show. I think it's worth watching. It's actually pretty fun. All the different speeches that were made were really interesting too. So if you're not going to go see Poor Things, maybe check out the SAG Awards because you get like a sense of what's out there, what's worth watching too.
Cool. Thank you so much. I'm glad you got to see Poor Things. I want to shout out Dune Part 2, which I hope everybody's planning to see this weekend.
I was trying to watch Dune Part 2 and then couldn't watch it, so watch Poor Things instead.
Have you seen Dune Part 1?
Yes, I love Doom Part 1.
Okay, yeah. So Doom Part 2 literally starts where the last one left off, which is good because I feel like Doom Part 1, the biggest problem is it just kind of ends and it feels like there was more story we were supposed to get like right there. I love this movie. I think Denis Villeneuve is a genius, and this is a 2 hour and 46 minute long movie, and I sat there and I was like, I did not even feel it. I did not, like, I could have been there for another 2 hours. I just love being in this world and how richly represented it is. Like, it is such a luscious, real-feeling world that Villeneuve has built. And this is more of an action movie than the first one. So the first Dune is, like, contemplative and setting up the plot. And it's like, oh, there's a big battle. And, like, you see...
God, I loved it, yeah.
I loved it. I love, like, just the feeling of being in it. And
the universe building was beautiful. I liked that
stuff.
A lot.
Like classic filmmaking, I'd say. So I'm glad the first movie was a success. I'm hoping people check this out. And if you do end up seeing this, go to like the biggest goddamn theater you can find, the biggest screen in your vicinity. So like full IMAX is a thing. I saw a press screening at a Dolby AMC screen, and I really like the Dolby cinemas because they have Dolby Vision. They also have these rumbly seats. The seats have transducers in them, so it's almost like haptic feedback for low-end frequencies when things rumble. And I will tell you, this movie has used those rumblers more than anything like I've ever seen before. Like, you know, no big spoiler here, but we all know from the trailers, this is a movie where, you know, people are going to be riding on sandworms. And there's a major scene where somebody is like learning how to ride a sandworm. That is, it felt like I was going to a massage parlor for like 30 minutes. It's just like on my back. It's just like, oh, this feels amazing. It's just like high, heavy duty rumbles. So go there. I'd recommend the Dolby Cinema for that just because it feels amazing. But yeah, any big screen, you know, that you can find for this thing is going to be amazing. I cannot wait to go back and see it again. I hope I have time to. That's Dune Part 2. It's good stuff. It's good classical, epic science fiction filmmaking. And we do not have enough of this. So I'm so glad that these movies are able to be made. So glad Villeneuve is around to make them.
Well, that's it for our episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for supporting us. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, the great Terrence O'Brien. This podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Twitter, Threads, wherever, Mastodon, Blue Sky, all over the place. I also podcast about movies and TV at thefilmcast.com.
If you need me, I am available everywhere. You can send me an email, chgr@engadget.com. Hit me up on X/Twitter, chgrlynnlow, or Threads, Instagram at Sherlinstagram. You know how to spell my name. Email us your thoughts about this show at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review, please, on iTunes, and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts.